Capital Region, this is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Today we have correspondent David Pablo's coverage of the Cricket Valley protest.
Then we have part two of Willie Terry's interview with HVCC's student government president, Zion Sharon.
And later on, the latest installment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics, with Megan Marin and David Barton.
After that, Andrea's interview with Bill Vitek regarding climate change.
Finally, HMM's Alexis Goldsmith interviews Jim Zak, who participated in the Nexum's now infamous Human Potential and Executive Leadership Program.
Let's jump to some headlines. After counting absentee ballots, the race for Troy's 2nd District Council seat is expected to go to Republican Kim Ash McPherson with a lead of 17 votes. But 22 ballots were left unopened due to concerns of voter fraud, while Democrats have until Thursday to seek those ballots opened in court.
And Troy's Mayor Patrick Madden has proposed handing off the development of the One Monument Square project to the Troy Local Development Corporation, an agency run by his office. It's a long-delayed project on site of the...
of the former City Hall, correct?
Thank you. That's it. I'm sure it is. On the former City Hall, it has stagnated for months. He touts the plan as an effort to speed up the process, while local Republicans have criticized the plan for a lack of transparency.
New York Attorney General Letitia James has announced a lawsuit against Juul, the e-cigarette company most closely associated with teen vaping. The suit alleges that the company used deceptive advertising and business practices to attract minors and get them addicted to nicotine. Juul currently makes up 70% of e-cigarette sales in the U.S.
And the foul weather on Tuesday morning left 6,000 Schenectady County residents without power, although it's now been restored for the majority of those affected. They also caused many car accidents across the capital region.
The City of Albany's Common Council passed its 2020 budget on Monday night. The proposed $90 per unit trash fee was not approved, while commercial taxes were raised slightly, and homeowner taxes should remain the same.
And for those who are just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
And for Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry was at Hudson Valley Community College on November 8th for an exclusive interview with Zion N. Sheehan, president of the HVV student government. This is part two of two parts.
I know at a lot of colleges there are issues that the students have to deal with, and some of the issues the administration don't want to deal with, but the students raise these issues. What are some of the critical issues that students have here that, you know, maybe the administration ain't brought up, but you as the student representative have to bring it up?
So something that was really relevant this semester, our school has always had parking tickets where they have the ticket that you put on, or registration, where you put it on the corner of your car and it gives you a certain number, and that's how they would scan to make sure your car was registered and wouldn't give you a ticket. Well, this semester they changed their system so that it's all electronic and you put in your plate number and then they scan your plate number and there's a lot of tickets. So that was something that was problematic because a lot of students would register for their thing and then you'd have to go back for it, but then they'd go to the registrar's office to ask for the little registration like sticker, and they would say, oh no, you're all set, we don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. So the students thought they were all set because that's what registrar's office said, but they didn't know what they meant is you don't need the sticker, you just need to do it online. Mm-hmm. So a lot of students were getting ticketed, And so it's something that we brought up to the public safety department, and something we're presently working on, trying to figure out a way that the students who got tickets are able to like get that removed from their record and everything. But presently, public safety is avoiding giving out tickets unless it's for something that's not registration related. Like if someone were to pull up and park in the middle of the grass on our campus where it's clearly not allowed to be parked, they'd still get a ticket. But when it comes to just registration problems, we're trying to put that on pause and figure out a way that we can make sure all the students that paid for registration actually don't get a non-registered vehicle ticket.
Right. Well, that is a critical issue.
Absolutely.
Right. They got a lot of parking lots here, you know. Do they have a problem with parking? Because they seem like they keep still building parking lots for us.
So something that I've realized, I've been able to connect to a lot of student governments across the country and even internationally. Mm-hmm. I was just at a conference the other week in Orlando, and there was a student government representatives there from Italy. So something that I've realized, though, being able to connect to all of these student governments, is parking is a problem on every campus. So Hudson Valley, from what I've seen at other campuses, actually our parking is not that bad. The first 3 weeks of the fall semester are normally pretty bad, but then as students realize when they need to come, realize that they can carpool with other students, realize that maybe it's faster to take the bus than it is to drive if they're really close by or just more convenient, then our parking problem significantly is reduced. So the first 3 weeks of the fall semester, it's very hard to find parking, but after that, it becomes a lot easier.
Right. Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's good. because, I mean, you know, it would be a long line when people would be driving up here coming into the school at certain points.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? Mm-hmm. Now, here at Hudson Valley, I know you have students from all over the world here coming here. It's a diversity of students here. How would you describe that environment here at Hudson Valley?
So for me personally, I prefer to talk about inclusion than diversity. Because for me, I feel like just having people from different backgrounds, and diversity is more than just religion and race. It's also age, gender identity, orientation, all of those things. So I feel like at Hudson Valley, it's not just that we have a diverse pool of students, we also have a fairly inclusive atmosphere on campus. So I really like it where you can learn a lot about different cultures. I've gotten to meet individuals who are from different countries who can tell me how their economics structure in that country works or their politics, which I find always fascinating because I'm really interested in that, or different like celebrations that they do in holidays. So I think that at Hudson Valley, the atmosphere is fairly accepting, and it's really nice to have that, especially in today's world where I feel like there's a lot of tensions on the national level.
Now, I know you just had the inauguration of your president here, right? Now, over your stint as student government, what has been your relationship with the school administration?
We have an advisor who technically is not considered administration, but he has a role that's closest to admin, in my view, which I have a very good relationship with. I really appreciate our advisor. I think he does a really good job and really knows his position well. As far as the president goes, I think he is an amazing individual. I had the privilege of having dinner with him with the entire e-board, except our treasurer, who at the time was in France, but he took the time to, for him and our vice president of student affairs, Mr. Copeland, they took us out to dinner, and the three students and the two administration just sat down and had really honest conversations, which was really nice. And whenever I see him, he makes a point to come over and ask how things are doing. So I think our relationship is very good.
I know a lot of students may be coming into the school, and then a lot of students see you as the president, and someone might aspire to be involved in student government, you know, maybe when you leave. What advice would you have for students who are thinking about getting involved in student government?
My advice would definitely be, one, you have to love it. It's a lot of work. So if you are going to do it and you're looking in specifically for the president role, I can't speak to the other roles because I haven't been all of them, but it is a lot of work and you have to know that you're getting into that. So come in prepared and with the expect to spend a lot of time on it. And also remember that we're student representatives, not just student leaders. Because a lot of times students have the idea that they're student leaders, so they should tell students how we should think. But to me personally, I feel like we're student representatives. So it's important to know all of the students and to hear their viewpoints. And when you go into a meeting, to make those your viewpoints. So instead of coming in and saying, this is what I think the student body should do, listen to the student body. Listen to where they want the college to go, how they want the college to do things, and then just be the voice for those students. So that's really my advice, is to really be a student representative, not just a student leader.
Yes, okay. And one last question, designer, I want to ask you. Now, all colleges are part of communities, and Hudson Valley is no exception. You know, it's part of the Troy community and other capital district community. Now, how do Hudson Valley student government and students relate or interact with the, let's say, the Troy community?
Okay, so for our local community, there are two things that stand out above everything else. So one of the things that I really enjoyed last year is we had a cultural pride night. So we had a lot of people that were students host the event and everything, but they also, the students invited their families. And the majority of our students on campus live within the localish area. I commute farther than typical, but the typical student commutes less than 35 minutes to get to school. So that was a way that they could bring in their families, and we could have an event that was thrown for, I thought it was an amazing event personally, and have the entire community enjoy it. We also, the student government also funds and manages the Pumpkin Palooza.
Right.
It's a huge event that we did, and it's held near Halloween. And the entire student government got costumes, and we all dressed up. I dressed up as Shrek. We had people from any sort of, like, we had Marvel characters and Disney and everything like that. And it was really great because we have students come, we get inflatable, like, bouncy house sort of things. And it's a way that we can have the community have a nice family outing. A lot of kids were there. I think we had over 900 members of our community come. So it was a very successful event. And I feel like that's one of the ways that we give back to our community, because our community does give so much to Hudson Valley.
Right. Okay, a lot of information. So now, what's your future? Where are you going after this?
So I don't presently have a school that I've been accepted to. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to say my ideal schools because I feel like that might jinx myself.
Oh, okay.
However, I am looking to transfer to a four-year school for economics or possibly finance. Mm-hmm. So depending the school, some I'd prefer to go economics, some I'd prefer to go finance, but I'd like to go economics and then I'm looking into my master's, possibly getting my MBA, JD mm-hmm. in a joint program, so that would be 4 years after my bachelor's.
Now, do you think you will get involved in the future in politics?
So I would love to get involved into politics later in life. At first, I would like a career in finance, mm-hmm. preferably, but that's one of the reasons that I would like economics, because I feel like economics would help me towards my degree in finance, but it all, or my career in finance, but it also would help me later if I wanted to run for something political. I also would consider higher education because I would like to work in a finance area that I could see as being fairly stressful, mm-hmm. and then moving into politics or higher education, which would also be stressful. I'm not saying it's a non-stress job, but it's a different atmosphere that I think I might appreciate after spending a long time in the finance world.
All right, there you have it, Zion, the president of Hudson Valley Community College Student Government. Well, we'll probably be seeing him sometime in the future again. Thank you, Zion.
Thank you.
That was Willie Terry with HVCC Student Government President Zion and Sharon. And up next, we'll move on to climate crisis issues. We're talking with William Vitek, professor of philosophy, climate scientist and jazz musician. The visiting lecturer is speaking at the RPI Climate Change Speaker Series, Engineering the Anthropocene. The visiting philosopher focuses on the changing climate's impact on humans and the human impact on climate change.
Do not discount yourself because you're not a scientist. That may actually be a positive thing.
We're not going to be able to just flick a switch, and technology is going to solve all of our problems for us.
Well, I think to that point, I mean, we are a very divided nation right now, and around the world, we are finding it more convenient to break into smaller and smaller groups and sort of shut ourselves in, whether it's on social media or just the way we identify ourselves as belonging to a group. That's worrisome, and I think the only way that's going to break down is if people take chances and reach out to neighbors they don't know and to do something radical and take a walk and try to say hello to everybody you walk by, or at least nod, or at least acknowledge that they're in your space. I mean, I think we can do lots of small things, but I think we have to start by saying there's no one answer, there's no one way to do it, there are lots of wrong ways to do it, and no one can do it alone. No perspective, whether it's science or technology or religion, can do it alone. So I think there's a great gathering that needs to happen, and it can happen in our neighborhoods, it can happen in our churches, schools, maybe the curriculum walls have to come down a little bit more, so that engineers and poets take classes together, and that young people are introduced to these big ideas early on in K-6, K-7, K-8. It's astonishing to me that most schools don't teach philosophy until, well, maybe high school if you're lucky, or college. I mean, and yet these are the big, deep questions. I think, you know, the bad news is the cascading crises going on around the world. The good news is it means all of us have something to do to participate, to help, and we have to admit that the experts don't know what to do, and maybe we don't know what to do. But when we don't know what to do, we can gather together and share and listen. So how we do that, I think it's part of the work of teachers and community leaders is to call these meetings, call these gatherings. I think it's a lonely time, and people are feeling isolated and afraid. And many years ago in upstate New York where I lived, there was an ice storm, and that ice storm was devastating. And what it did is bring people out of their houses and together. And yes, there was a little bit of thievery that went on, but most people took care of one another. So in times of crises, we might actually find it easier to get more together than apart.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because it isn't just the scientists who are responsible, or big business that is responsible, or the government. It's all of us together. Need to actually take some action. I mean, even if it's just growing your own food and you're in a spot on your grass. You had a wonderful article about the lovely dandelion. I'd love to hear that story.
Well, you know, sure. You know, so many of the plants in the United States, and it's probably true in other parts of the world, are listed as weeds, and in some cases the phrase is noxious weeds. And the funny thing about weeds is that they're beautiful. They often have medicinal qualities. Native peoples from around the world use these plants to heal themselves, to celebrate, to survive. In the agricultural setting in the last 10,000 years, more and more plants came to be seen as competitors with our annual food crops. And so we spent a lot of time in the last 10,000 years weeding. And these plants turn out to be really good at surviving that, and because in part they're perennials. They've just been around longer, and annual plants just have to be taken care of and protected. So what I did with this little piece you mentioned is to talk about that we need to reconcile with our weeds. We need to reconcile with the rest of the living world that we call a weed because it's interfering with something we want, and yet it is powerful and beautiful and resilient. And it's part of this regenerative agriculture that we need to start to look at natural systems in their wholes and realize that so much of agriculture depended on keeping a lot of that ecological richness out of our plots because they interfered with those little baby plants that we were trying to grow. So, it goes back to what Henry David Thoreau said, in wildness is the preservation of the world. And that's a lot of what I've been doing lately is to help us reconnect to our wild selves, to the wild world, to see that this world that we live in is endlessly creative and destructive, but it's in cycles. And we've lost touch with that world. We've seen it as an enemy. And we do the darndest things to get rid of these plants and animals by poisoning them, and then we poison ourselves. So it's just a call to see the living world around us, including those pesky dandelions, as they belong there in a way, and that we need to sort of become friends again with them in some ways, or at least understand them. And I keep bringing this back to our agricultural paradigm, which is to grow monocultural plants, nearly all of them in annuals, so they have to be planted as seeds every year. And the only way they'll survive is if those other plants that have overwintered don't get a head start, and so they become our weeds. And it's a re-relationing, I guess I'd call it. So.
It was wonderful when you said that the roots of a dandelion are so deep, and each little petal is a flower of its own. And
yeah.
I just thought that's humanity right there.
You've
got deep roots, and everything has a value of its own, then it's something to respect. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this has been absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
One thing that I started to think about when I realized that you were also a jazz musician, I thought, how has jazz influenced your outlook of science, and how has science made an impact on your music? Is that too much of a question all at once?
No, I love it. I mean, science has made an impact on my music because I can take electronic instruments with me anywhere, and it feels like I'm playing an actual piano. So I love the mobility that science has given for making music in places where there aren't. I'm a piano player, so it's the most beautiful of pianos are 800 to 1200 pound monstrosities that can't be taken around. So in some ways, science has made playing music more portable and easier. I think being a jazz pianist has greatly informed my work as a philosopher, because of the notion of improvisation and what it requires, and the way in which it helped me see that the universe itself is a kind of big improvisational orchestra. I call it the Big Bang Orchestra, and it has a way of, you know, each part does its own thing, but not in isolation. And what jazz musicians do is, while they're playing essentially the same song, what one of them does in an improvisational moment changes what the rest of the players will do in that moment too. It's a great and challenging art because you're playing, you have to follow a form. There's structure, there's harmony, there's rhythm. You need to come in at the same time and end at the same time, but in between there's all these moments of surprise and responding to it, and that's how that music is made. And I think that's how the universe works. And so it's helped me practice it, both as a musician, but also as a teacher, making sure that I listen to my students and respond to their, as it were, performances and improvisations in the classroom, their questions. So it's just, for me, a great way of thinking about the way nature works, too. Let's go back to those dandelions. A dandelion planted in shade is going to develop differently than a dandelion planted in sun. It's who you're with, right? Not only love the one you're with, play with who you're with. I mean, it's going to change you. And so, and it just brings together this sense that, again, we can't do it alone. We are in partnership. Jazz music requires a huge amount of trust. I like to tell people, when you know, an artist works in her studio and the work shows up at a gallery. Musicians, jazz musicians, are sort of in their studio on stage. So they're making art, and sometimes it doesn't go well, right? But they're doing it live in front of an audience. For me, jazz has been a wonderful chance to experience what creative improvisation is and how it works.
Is there something you can help with as far as doing something with climate cultural challenges that we all seem to have at the moment?
Yeah, find a plant nearby, a tree, a bush, not a flower. It's wintertime now, and spend some time with that tree or that place, and think about all the relationships it has, and tie that into all the relationships you have. And so I think, in some ways, we want to take all the things that make us human and turn them sort of outward and think about what it means to be that tree or that plant. See the similarities, but also see them as teachers, too.
Thank you.
Take care.
That was RPI Visiting Speaker Series continues throughout the academic year, examining the intersections of philosophy, the earth, and the human impact on the climate change and the science and technology in social environmental change. For more information, go to www.ceerpi.edu/climate.
For those just tuning in, I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 Schenectady.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And Jim Zak was a participant in the Nexus, now infamous, Human Potential and Executive Leadership Program. He spoke with HMM's Alexis Goldsmith about the experience after attending a reading by Chet Hardin at the Sanctuary on the book, The Program, Insides the Mind of Keith Renifer and the Rise and Fall of Nexum.
I'm here with Jim Zak, who was recruited into Nexium's program. Welcome to the show, Jim, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Alexis.
How long were you in the program?
I just did one intensive, and it was back in 2004 or 5. So the intensive was a 5-day program, and I remember I was recruited at the Green, there was a vegetarian restaurant on Lark Street, Green something, Green Room, Green House, Green, the juice bar and vegetarian food. And I was with a vegetarian meetup group from Saratoga. We met down there and I was approached by Omar, a gentleman who was, you know, nominally with us in the group, and he talked to me a little bit about Nexium and the Executive Success Program.
And how did he describe it?
I can't remember, just, you know, it appealed to me. I've been interested in the Human Potential movement and the Human Potential programs, such as the S training, which I did back in the 80s. Whatever he said kind of resonated with me and made me feel as if I could be part of a group, you know, of like-minded people. And the fact that he picked me out of this group stroked what ego I had at the time.
Do you think they told people different things about it, depending on, you know, what they knew about you and what might appeal to you?
He did not know anything about me. I think it was he was casting his net, trying it out on a couple of people. I think the fact that it was a vegetarian meetup group kind of conformed with the lifestyle that I was introduced to at the New Carner Road facility when I did the training. They had a vegetarian bar. Found out later Keith Raniere, the Vanguard, was vegetarian. So I think it was a very targeted marketing approach. I had subsequently found that they used a vegan cafe in Saratoga Springs for some recruitment purposes, approaching people there. So
everybody talks about modules and you know, intensives. What is a module in the program?
The intensive consisted of several modules, and they had names. And I kind of feel as if it went in one ear and out the other, or after time, and nothing stuck. It's kind of like when I did the S training. I can't recall anything more than a couple of snippets, but things did stick with me from the S training. And I can only remember snippets from the Executive Success Program as well. One thing that I remember distinctly was there was a question put before me. It was put before all of us, if any one of us had discovered the cure to cancer, and a medical cure for cancer, would we be better off giving it away to the world for free, or becoming extremely wealthy for being the first person to discover it? And I was pretty altruistic at the time, and I definitely thought giving it away sounded like the right answer, but a convincing argument followed that no, deserved to profit from that.
One of the central tenets of NXIVM's training was to control as much wealth as possible.
I believe that was one of them, yep.
And how did that resonate with you?
So it was all counter to, I wanted to see where it was going, how they could justify some of the principles, the 12 principles that were outlined at core tenets of the Executive Success Program.
So while you're in it, were you like, oh, this is making sense? And then later you were like, there's something not right about this? Or what was your reaction to it?
Never really made much sense to me. After I got out, I kept being called by a woman, Storm, I think was her name. And there was a follow-up. They were checking in, making sure I was still with them, kind of thing. Did I want to go to they had volleyball games in Latham on Friday night at midnight. This was at a gym on 9R, right off of 9R, and I thought about going, but I was very much into volleyball at the time, and I never went. I never did anything outside the group. I never had any more contact with the group after that. I met one gentleman that I remained friendly with for about a month after leaving, but never again.
Did you sense that there was anything darker going on at the time?
Nothing related to the whole sex cult or money, not laundering money, massive money accumulation, funneling money from the Bronfman sisters or any of that. No. As a matter of fact, later on, I did see people attacking NXIVM as a cult, and I had heard that the cult term applied to people who had done the S training as well. You know, like, oh, you're in that cult. And it's like, I'm reminded, you know, yeah, until you tried something, you can't really call it a cult. But my behavior didn't change that much. I had heard, you know, what Tony had said after the talk tonight about how things can change in behavior after when someone enters a cult. And I don't think any of that really applied to me. It did seem strange, though, that, you know, that was the Nexus was the New Karner facility where they had a vegan juice bar, everything was free kind of thing, as I recall. You can hang out there whenever you wanted, you know, home away from home.
And what year was this?
This was about 2004, 5, maybe even 6, I'd have to look again.
And then what was your reaction when the press broke the branding story?
Oh my gosh, it was just like, I mean, by that time I had reached the conclusion that Keith was, you know, not all he was hyped up to be, or he hyped himself up to be, and that the organization was not as on the level. But I never suspected anything that bizarre.
And then they asked you to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
Oh, well, yeah.
What was their reasoning?
Well, the technology, to protect the technology. That's typically, I've signed non-disclosure agreements with other, in my professional career, to protect sensitive information and intellectual property.
They were using technology in the program?
Mind technology, not computer technology or machinery technology, but, you know, human behavior modification programming.
Since, have you met anybody else who was in the program?
No, I have heard of someone that I do know through a third party who told me about someone that I know. I have not approached that person, though, but I did hear a horror story about him, how he was invited to one of Keith's Vanguard days up at Silver Bay on Lake George. And evidently my friend was pretty high up because Keith gave him, I'm using quotes there, air quotes, gave him a woman for the night. And this third party friend of mine who told me that he actually impregnated the woman in the course of the night. I can't confirm that story. I assume it's true, but and I've never confronted my friend about that.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us. I know it's kind of terrifying once you've signed that non-disclosure agreement.
That was Alexis Goldsmith speaking with Jim Zach, a former member of NXIVM, about his experience with the infamous group.
And as we reported on Monday, there was a large direct action at Cricket Valley Energy on Saturday. For our next segment, we hear directly from many of the protesters on the scene.
This is the Dutchess County Sheriff's Office and New York State Police. This is the third and final warning. Be advised that you are trespassing on private property. Please leave the premises immediately or be subject to arrest.
This is Dave Pablo for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm at the Cricket Valley Energy Center, and I'm standing with Kim Fratchek of St. Energy Project. Kim, why are you here this morning?
This is the largest fracked gas power plant being constructed in the Northeast. It was approved over a decade ago on old climate science when people thought that natural gas was a bridge fuel. There's nothing natural about natural gas. This is fracked gas. This is coming from the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania. It's highly radioactive. It is horrible for our health and safety. It's also damaging to the largest freshwater wetlands in New York State called the Great Swamp, which it is being built directly on. It will destroy the ecosystem that is so precious to this region. Additionally, not only is it bad for our health and safety and our environment, but it is really bad for our economics. So, for instance, this is going to lock us into a future of fossil fuels and leave us all with stranded assets to continue paying for this plant when fossil fuels are now obsolete. It also goes against all of our climate goals and our climate law in New York State. Governor,
how so?
Well, we just passed a climate law called the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act in New York, and we also have a goal to reach net zero emissions by 2050. This is going to take us in the wrong direction. And additionally, it will leave all of the ratepayers to foot the bill to continue paying for this plant long after it's not even functioning anymore.
So for our radio listeners, paint a picture for us. What are we doing right now? Where are we standing?
We are standing in the driveway of the Cricket Valley Energy Center to prevent work from happening. People have petitioned, written letters, filed lawsuits, appealed to their elected officials. Governor Cuomo continues to say he doesn't know anything about this and that it's out of his hands. And now people have decided that civil disobedience and direct action is the step to take. We're looking right now at a large tractor with residents and local farmers locked down to it to prevent workers from getting into the worksite to complete this plant.
And I can also see up in the distance on the smokestacks, there appear to be a bunch of banners that are floating up there, which I'm guessing are not customary.
There are several well-equipped climbers that have climbed to the top of the 275-foot smokestack underneath this beautiful moon and blue sky, and they're flying red and yellow banners that say resist.
How long do you plan to stay here?
We got this. We want to continue to shut this work site down for the whole day.
What are you hoping to gain from this today?
Well, our target for this is definitely Governor Cuomo. We know that we have an alternative to this plant to bring electricity from wind power upstate to downstate, and we shouldn't be messing with fracked gas anymore. So Governor Cuomo has the power to halt this plant. 40 years ago, his father, Governor Mario Cuomo, shut down the Shoreham nuclear power plant because it was not safe for the residents around Shoreham in Long Island. And that was right after the plant was finished construction. So it's not like we can't shut this down. It's not operational yet. We have every way that we can shut this down. It just takes Governor Cuomo standing in his climate leadership and owning that.
Sure. My name is Rob.
My name is Maggie.
I'm Bill.
I have family in Ulster County and grew up in the Hudson Valley.
I live in Millerton, just north of here.
I currently live where the pipeline stops, but I lived for 4 years in the Hudson Valley.
It's not just what's happening to this community in the Harlem Valley, but it's also where the gas is actually being fracked from out in the shale fields in Pennsylvania. And people are dying out there. And
dying how?
Well, they're getting sick. They're getting cancer. They can't drink their water. And I think we really need to have a conversation about we're treating our neighbors and fellow community members as resource colonies, and that has to end. And that's what we're here today to demand.
Because this is farmland. The farmers around here, we're in solidarity with the farmers, with the residents, with the children. There are 600 children that are within a very close range of here, plus there's an elementary, middle school, and high school within 2 to 4 miles of here, so there's probably over 1,000 children. And the VOCs alone, the particulate matter, but the VOCs, the benzene, all of these carcinogens going into the air will affect these children, as well as elderly, as well as everybody. So we're here for them.
I think it comes down to the power plant is unjust, and it is a representation of a broadly unjust system that rewards oh so few people with lots of power and lots of money and puts the rest of us in peril and in danger, and especially puts forth the poorest of people and people of color to face the repercussions of what the fossil fuel industry and what fracking is doing to our communities more broadly. So any way that we can step up and try to block this from happening is something that I feel like is my responsibility to do.
Well, I feel like I should try and speak for some of those who have no voices, and those are the animals that live around here. The power plant is built right on the edge of a wetland called the Great Swamp, and it is a beautiful nature preserve, I would say. Not that it's being preserved in any way, but nobody has disturbed it for hundreds of years, and there are many species who live in it and other species who rely on it for their nests, for their food, as a migration path. And this power plant is going to destroy that, as well as very large swaths of forest and wetland throughout this area. One of the things that the power plant does is it emits sulfur dioxide and sulfuric acid. And we all know back years ago that there was a thing called acid rain that really started killing trees and destroying the environment. And that's exactly what's going to happen here, except in a very concentrated local way. So I'm really afraid that everything that you see around here, all the beauty that you see in this part of the Hudson Valley, is going to be destroyed. And that's the acute effect right here. And then, of course, as this pumps millions of tons of carbon dioxide and carbon dioxide equivalents into the atmosphere, that effect becomes global. And then everyone suffers. So that's what I'm thinking about right now.
And we know that in your heart of hearts, you don't want to work for these fossil fuel gangsters. You don't want to work for them. You know what fracking wells do to the atmosphere, to our soil and our water. You know about the methane, and you know what it's doing to your children. But when you get into that uniform, then all of a sudden you've got to agree with everybody else, and you're all agreeing with the gangsters at the top. You don't have to. You don't have to do that. You are free. You are free individuals. Look into it. Study what's going on. Find out the truth. Go into that woods. Be with nature. Be with the earth.
Governor Cuomo, you signed the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act this last summer. And that act promised that New York State's energy supply was going to be fossil-free by 2040. I don't see how that can happen when we're just about to bring one of the largest frack gas power plants in the Northeast online in a couple of months. So, yeah, complete the legacy and stop this plan, please.
That was correspondent Dave Pablo at Saturday's protest at Cricket Valley Energy Center. Representatives of Cricket Valley Energy declined to comment for this report. We will be posting a montage of many of the sounds from this protest on SoundCloud, including songs from Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir and the Tin Horn Brass Band, so be sure to check that out.
And for our last segment this evening, we have another installment of Equality Under the Law, Practical Physics with Megan Maroon and David Borton. On this week's episode, they discuss life in the Adirondacks as a kid and studying the laws of the universe under the stars.
Hey, Dr. Borton.
Hi, Megan. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm holding a piece of serpentine, and I heard that's a stone that was in the ground near your hometown, birthplace.
Yeah, eastern Pennsylvania has a bunch of houses that are made out of serpentine stone, and I was born in Bryn Mawr, which is not far from where that is.
Oh, I thought you were joking that there were houses made out of serpentine.
No. Stone houses, right? Stone houses are made out of whatever stone is around. Brownstone in Troy, there's a lot of that. In eastern Pennsylvania, there's some houses that are made out of serpentine.
Well, I guess when you look at a small piece of serpentine, it's so beautiful. It's a green, speckled, but cloudy, and it feels like it has iron in it.
Well, I don't know if it has iron in it. I really don't know that much about it, but one of the things that the serpentine in stone houses has is sort of sparkles, because it is a cleaved rock, so the rock was cracked, whereas the rock that you're looking at the moment is polished, and so it's smooth, and so that some of that sparkliness has been taken away.
Well, it's beautiful. I'd like to see some of these serpentine homes. And then when you were a child, you would vacation up in the Adirondacks, right?
Ah, yes, very much so. Pretty much every year of my life, and until I went to college, basically, I spent every summer, all summer, in the Adirondacks.
Was there running water and, you know, was it like a full camp?
Well, we called it pretty posh because what we did from this camp was go out and canoe and hike, backpack. And so we were, you know, living in tents and moving our stuff with our bodies and setting up fires to cook on and all that. And so that the camp that we're talking about now had wooden platforms with the tents that we made. And we had running water because we had a tank on the hill that we filled up and gravity brought the water down. And there was a kitchen. And when I was little, the kitchen had wood stoves, then it got propane stoves. And when I was little, it had an ice house, and then we got propane refrigeration. And recently, we put in solar photovoltaic electric refrigeration. That's pretty soft in a place that has no road, no electricity, and outhouses.
Wow. So, in my imagination, I'm thinking, was it there when you were just a little tyke that you slept out under the stars and started thinking about how to find meaning in coming into this planet Earth?
Well, the stars weren't quite so much the meaning as sitting around looking at the water and the trees and the ferns and the animals, because there was life spread out in front of me. And that life was basically independent of me. I had a life, and I was with people that had a life, but then the whole forest ecosystem was alive, basically independent of us humans that, you know, come to visit and enjoy nature.
Doesn't that point run contrary to what we're finding out, though, that you actually aren't separate from that ecosystem? Or are you making a different point?
Well, you asked about, you know, how I got into science, and you talked about the stars, and I'd like to sit out under the stars and look at them. But they were sort of far away, and they were suns, and, you know, so they're out there. What was more real to me was what was around me, and what was around me was the forest primeval.
So, I mean, how old were you when you first had a class or opened a book in physics?
Oh, well, okay, the class in physics probably started when I was moving stones as a kid as playing, you know, piling up stones. Because piling up stones means you're doing work and you're doing equilibrium and balance and strength of materials and all those things. And for me, it was just play.
Yeah, but you know, like when did you open up a book and it was like, you know, physics is what runs the universe, you know, and then chapter one, this theory.
Oh, okay, well, there was something called...
This law, excuse me.
There was something called earth science, and earth science was not so much of a science. I enjoyed it, but it wasn't as much science as I would have liked. But then when you got to physics, and physics says, oh, well, here's something of this mass, and here's something of this mass, and how does one move the other, or how does one interact when they hit each other, or that kind of interaction, I'd experienced that. So when you talk about levers and you say the force times the distance here equals the force times the distance here, and the work involved is equal, but you can move huge rocks even though you're a small little kid with a lever.
So what was the first law of physics that you feel like you really internalized, both in your body and your mind?
Okay, I guess that would have to be work and energy. Well, you know, you're asking me to remember something that I can't remember, so I'm trying to figure out what it
probably...
Should
I set the scene? There are sparks and embers coming up from the fire. I'm trying to set an Adirondack scene to get you to remember.
Well, if you bring...
Partially because I want to be in the Adirondacks.
If you bring up fire, then what comes to my mind is the work involved in getting firewood. Because, first of all, you have to know what is good firewood and what is not. You don't want to take a wet balsam log and try to burn it. And if you happen to find some balsam that's very dry, that's good for starting a fire, but it's not good for keeping a fire going. You want to find a nice hardwood that's dry to keep a fire going. So if you call that physics, that's a very basic thing that I started early.
Well, and obviously the study of physics involves math. So did it so happen that when you entered your first formal physics class, I'm assuming in high school, that you had already been quite the whiz in math, that you like were drawn to math class and that you really liked it and were high achieving?
Well, all I can say is that math is easy. It's very straightforward. 1 + 1 = 2, and 2 times pi is this number that's pretty close to some other number. So yeah, math is easy and certainly part of physics. And later on, when you're doing advanced physics, it's very nice to do advanced math at the same time, because the math and the physics go hand in hand, and you can understand the math better if it's related to a physical problem. Like, for instance, do you know what a gradient is?
Well, sometimes it'll say, you know, steep gradient. Careful where you're walking or rollerblading.
Right. Well, gradient is a mathematical term. It's a derivative of some function with respect to some variable, and it can have multiple variables. And so in physics, that is very basic to things like gravitational fields. Mm. And so the math and the physics go together, so it helps you understand both.
Cool. Could you just tell us about that first physics class? What was it like? Do you remember?
Well, some of the first physics class was this guy that's, you know, up there sort of talking with a dry sense of humor. And I like that about science. You can be humorous about it. And he would say things like, this is hot. And he would touch something and you could tell it was hot. Or this has electricity in it and a spark would come out. And you could see and hear the spark. He said, now this is a wheel that generates static electricity by separating charge. Wow, who knew? Separating charge. Okay, that's pretty cool. That's what runs our bodies, right? And our minds and all that stuff. And so here was this machine that you turned a wheel, and by moving different insulators with respect to each other and connecting them with conductors, you could get very high voltages and generate really big sparks. And you did that by putting work into this wheel, and you got electrical work out of it. Cool.
Really cool.
So there are multiple ways of doing that. And what I was just talking about was static electricity, and then you move on to electromagnetism, and that's where you put work into moving a coil with respect to a magnet, and that generates electricity, moving electricity energy. And it's the flows of energy in the world that keep us alive. And so to understand these flows of energy, either as a kid piling up rocks or flows of energy that are causing climate change in the planet, you know, it's all energy.
Well, do you have any advice to a student who, or a young person who's out, you know, chopping wood and getting curious about the laws that, you know, allow heat conduction to happen or allow for gravity to keep us magnetized to the planet?
Well, stay curious about your subjects, because if you're curious about math and science, physics, chemistry, biology, you're going to have a good time and you're going to learn a lot.
Well, thank you, Dr. Borton.
Megan, it's always a pleasure.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Eric Newton.
And I'm Andrea Cunliffe. Our engineer tonight was Erica Dulcinea. Remember to turn back tomorrow evening, tomorrow and every day at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in from 7 to 10 weeknights on Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that's creative and dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. Or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m., held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.